Now, in our first two chapters, a number of surgeries that they are described in this way. It was the intention of the reader that Arthur said to give us the opinion that we had to have this in order to recover. Amongst our rapidly going fellowship and this group to hear them, there are such, these things do occur very rarely, but they still occur. It was rare in those days, and it was rare today. But he says most of our spiritual experiences are what the psychologist William James classifies one of an educational variety, one that might take slowly over a period of time. As we learn and apply, we will change gradually. Most of us are going to have this particular type of thing. He says this thing will be so gradually that others may notice the change before you do. But eventually, he says that you will have a point of recognition. And our book will talk about this later. It will say that for anything to be successful, you should have a recognition. And it says that this point of recognition is what we call our spiritual awareness, our spiritual awakening. So we're talking about an experience, spiritual experience, which we may not know that is taking place, but there will be a point of awareness where you have seen the results of this thing. And this is called the spiritual awakening. Two different type of things. So, he says later that we find that no one need have difficulty with spirituality of this program. Willingness, open honesty, and open-mindedness are essential of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which they bar against all information, and which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is prior contempt prior to investigation. So we're looking for a spiritual experience which we may or may not occur simultaneously with the awakening, and we are also looking for the part of awareness, and this will come. So he says in this chapter, he tells us exactly what has got to take place. A personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism brought about by a spiritual experience, which may be slowly over a period of time, or it may be of a sudden nature.
Chuck? I'd like to go to page 26, and there is a solution, and there's a story here. Let's finish two, and then we'll break. Okay. There's a story here that I think we need to look at, because it brings in this other doctor that Joe referred to a while ago. And you remember up to this point in the book, we've accomplished two things, really. We have identified our problem back in Dr. Silkworth's opinion. We've identified with another alcoholic in Bill's story. And they have told us that the solution to this thing is to have this spiritual experience. Dr. Silkworth referred to it as the psychic change. If you look at the asterisk and go back in the appendices and read, you find that you can also call it a spiritual awakening. In any case, they're telling me here in Chapter 2 that I'm going to have to deal with something spiritual as a solution to my alcoholism. And I don't really like this. I don't really like to have to deal with something spiritual. You know, I had that good-natured contempt that Bill had of all them people that went to church and prayed and acted like they were good Christians, and then I'd see them in the dance hall on Friday night with somebody else's wife, and I thought they were all a bunch of damned hypocrites. But we have a little story here on page 26 about a certain American businessman who had ability and good sense and high character. He said for years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of the mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor. whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on the earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Here's the second warning in the book. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with this doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you." Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there he is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional arrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description." Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor's telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. And again an asterisk, and again a reference to the appendix. Now this story was brought to Bill before Alcoholics Anonymous was ever started. This story was carried to Bill by an old friend who had joined the Oxford groups. And this old friend in the Oxford groups had had what he called a religious experience, what Dr. Jung referred to as the vital spiritual experience. Bill now had received two pieces of information from two doctors. He had received the concept of the allergy to alcohol from Dr. Silkworth. He had received from this psychiatrist in Europe, which treated a man that came back to the States and told Roland H., and Roland H. told Bill about it, of the vital spiritual experience was the way to recover from alcoholism. Now, if I'm reading this book and I'm reading it close up to this point, they've got me interested, real interested. They have identified the problem for me. They have given me a solution. And the solution is going to be this spiritual way of life. I don't like that solution at all. But I know I'm going to have something, or I'm going to die from alcoholism. Now on page 29, they tell me one more great thing. They say, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 36 personal experiences. Again, we're not dealing with generalities. They've alerted me that later on in this book, they're going to give me some clear-cut directions to show me how they had this vital spiritual experience, this spiritual awakening, whatever we wish to call it. And I think with that, if Joe is agreeable, we'll break for about 10 minutes. mind to go blind. We've got a certain place in the book that we like to get to before we break for the night, so we're going to try to move along as fast as we can and get up to this one particular point. We've just completed now talking about chapter 2, There Is a Solution. And remember, as we said in the beginning, the big book really does three things. We have now had the identification of the problem, which was Dr. Silkworth's opinion. We've had the identification with another alcoholic through Bill's story. And we now have found out that the common solution is a spiritual way of life. Now, these first 100 people in AA were pretty smart people. They pretty well know and knew at that time their feelings toward anything spiritual. And most of them knew how they felt about God and religion and prayer and everything else when they first came in AA. So what they're just about to say to me is this. They're about to say, Charlie, we understand the way you feel toward God. And we understand the way you feel toward spiritual experiences. And we know the way you feel about any kind of spiritual life or prayer of any form. And they're saying, at this point of the game, you may not yet really recognize the full need and the full reason for having to have this spiritual experience. And they're saying, maybe we ought to jar you just a little bit more, Charlie. Maybe we ought to really tell you what's going to happen to you if you don't have this vital spiritual experience. And they sat down and they wrote a whole chapter, and they entitled it Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism. And in Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, we find that they close the doors for the excuses that I'm going to try to make. They tell the story in here about this guy named Jim, who owned the lucrative automobile agency. And they tell the story about Jim having come to AA, and he had lost his lucrative automobile agency because of his drinking. And after coming in AA, and he began to get his life straightened out, and he got his family back, and he got his wife back, got his children back, and he went to work as a salesman for this automobile agency which he once owned. And they tell that Jim one day, he was kind of out of sorts, didn't feel too good. And he kind of resented the fact that he had to work for the place that he used to own. And he decided he would go out in the country and he would visit a prospect for a new car to see if he couldn't get a new car sold to him. And on his way out to this new prospect that he was going to visit, Jim passed a roadhouse which had a bar in it. And Jim decided that he would stop and have lunch. And Jim said this wasn't anything new, because during this period of sobriety, he had been in and out of this place many times. And he went in and he sat down and he ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. And Jim drank the sandwich and, or drank the, ate the sandwich and drank the glass of milk. And while he was sitting there, he decided he would have another sandwich and another glass of milk. And the thought crossed his mind that if I would put some whiskey in this milk and mix it up and take it on a full stomach, it wouldn't hurt me. And with no more thought than this, Jim ordered a shot of whiskey and poured it in a glass of milk. And then he had another and another and another. The phenomenon of craving developed. The allergy took over. It was virtually impossible for him to stop drinking. And here Jim started on another one of his drinking sprees. Now, Jim was filled with self-knowledge about alcoholism. Jim had been to AA. And Jim knew that if he drank again, he would lose the job that he had. He knew that if he drank again, he would probably lose his wife and his children. He knew that if he drank again, he would probably end up in the hospital. The only defense that Jim put up against the first drink, he says, I vaguely sensed that I was not being too smart. But I didn't think it would hurt me, with a glass of milk and a full stomach. They tell the story about a man named Fred. And Fred was a well-known accountant and a very successful businessman. And Fred went to Washington to present some accounting evidence, and the business in Washington went off very well, very successful. Not a cloud in the sky, not a cloud on the horizon. The end of a perfect day. Fred was pleased and Fred was happy. And Fred knew that his partners in his accounting firm would also be happy because it had been a successful business trip. And Fred went back to the hotel and he dressed for dinner. And he went down to the dining room, and as he crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that a cocktail before dinner would certainly taste good. And Fred had a cocktail before dinner, and he had another, and he had another, and he had another. And he went to the airport, and he flew back to New York City, and his wife was there to meet him, but he couldn't find her, so he got a taxi cab driver. And this friendly taxi cab driver drove him around town for a period of days. And finally, Fred ended up back in the hospitals again. Now, Fred had been to AA also. And Fred had talked with the people in AA, and they'd told him what they knew of alcoholism. And Fred had told these people, "Yes, I agree with you that I have some of the same problems. But I believe the self-knowledge that I now have will fix it." And the interesting part about Fred's story is he didn't even vaguely sense that he was doing something wrong. He made no fight whatsoever against the first drink. And in the chapter To Move About Alcoholism, they give me one example to compare my alcoholism to. They talk about a man who has a passion for jaywalking in front of cars, jumping out in front of fast-moving vehicles, and he gets a thrill and an excitement out of this, and he gets by with this for many years, but one day one runs over him and breaks his leg, and they put him in the hospital. And the doctor says, "Hey, Joe, you better quit this damn jumping in front of them cars, because someday it's going to kill you." And he says, "Oh, Doc, don't worry, I'm through with that. I don't want any more of this stuff. I've hurt about all I can possibly stand to hurt. I'm not going to do that no more." And his leg gets well, and he gets out of the hospital, and he goes back on the streets about his normal business. And then he has a feeling of restlessness and irritability and discontent, and he's missing something in his life. And he begins to think about jumping in front of these fast-moving vehicles. And one day, the thought came to mind so strong that he just couldn't resist it, so he jumped out in front of them again. And they run over him, and they broke his back. And they put him in the hospital, and the doctor said, "Hey, Joe, you better quit that jumping in front of those fast-moving vehicles. It's going to kill you." And his employer says, "Joe, if you keep this up long enough now, you're missing too much work, and if you continue doing this, I'm going to fire you from your job." And his wife says, "I'm getting tired of you laying up here in this damn hospital instead of making a living." She says, "I'm getting tired of supporting you and taking care of you. If you don't get yourself straightened out, I'm going to divorce you." And he says, "Oh, don't worry. I'm through. I've quit. I'll never jump in front of a fast-moving vehicle again as long as I live." And they release him from the hospital, and he goes on about his business. And then one day he gets the urge, and he does it again. And he jumps out in front of these fast-moving vehicles, and they this time one hits him and fractures his skull. And they throw him in the hospital, and these people all tell him the same thing. And he says, "I quit." And on through the years, this conduct continues. And he's held up to ridicule. And he loses his job, and he loses his wife, and he loses his children. And he shuts himself up in asylums and hospitals, hoping for a cure. But every time he hits the streets, he goes out, and he jumps in front of fast-moving vehicles, until eventually one day one runs over him and kills him. Now, the book says, you may think that this illustration is too ridiculous, but is it in the light of our alcoholism? We have the crazy, insane urge that comes on us from time to time, which says, "Let's have a drink." And in chapter 3, it tells me that the alcoholic at certain times is unable to recall to mind with sufficient force and memory the suffering and the pain and the humiliation of the last drunk. That his mind simply says, let's have a drink. And again, I look back at my drinking career, and I see the many, many times that I quit drinking, that I swore off. I put the cork in the jug, and I fully intended to stop drinking. There's no doubt about this in my mind at all. I had full intention of never taking another drink. And for a short period of time, I wouldn't have any problems, but I would find that I would be restless, and I would be irritable, and I would be discontented. And I'd be full of shame and guilt and remorse. And I'd be worried about what the neighbors thought about me because, after all, my wife had sued me for divorce 3 times, and I took her back every time. Continually worried about the finances and what the banker was going to do and so on and so forth. And I just didn't feel good, and my mind would begin to toy with the idea of taking a drink. And I can remember this so distinctly. And at first I'd say, no, you can't drink. Don't you remember that last drunk? Don't you remember what's going to happen if you drink again? Don't you know that you can't drink that alcohol? And my mind would say, yes, I do remember that. But as days would go by, my mind would continue to toy with the idea of a drink. And finally, my mind would get around to saying, you know, maybe something just this simple. That here it is a hot day and a cold beer sure would taste good. Or here it is a cold day in the wintertime and man, wouldn't a hot drink of whiskey taste good? And from that, my mind would go to the fact that, well, you know, maybe it really wasn't quite as bad as I thought it was. Maybe this time I could take 2 drinks and be able to drink like a gentleman and stop. Or this time I'm only going to get a 6-pack of beer. And I would argue with myself back and forth, and then it seemed to me as all of a sudden my mind just went blank. And it said, zap. And it refused to remember the last drunk. It refused to remember the threat of the divorce and the foreclosure on the mortgage and the going to jail and back to the hospital. And the mind said, let's take a drink. And I'd take that drink, and the phenomenon of craving would develop. And I would go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And what they're telling me, and more about alcoholism, that the human power as marshaled by the will is not sufficient to keep me from taking the first drink. And they've used the stories to illustrate this. And by the time I read chapter 3 and read it thoroughly, I am convinced that I have an obsession of the mind. I am convinced that my willpower will not keep me sober. And they put it in here to re-emphasize the idea that I must find this spiritual way of living if I want to stay sober. My book tells me that the idea someday, somehow someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. My book says that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. And I found this was the most difficult concession to make that I'd ever made in my life. I found that this was the most difficult decision to say that I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink like other people. But through the reading of chapter 3, I became convinced that by myself, I would be unable to keep from taking the first drink.
I think the third chapter we see plays a unique role. We'll notice later, and we're going to move into the area of discussion of the books and the steps, and we'll know basically that the first chapter dealing with the first 2 steps and the doctor's opinion gives us 2 basic ideas that we were powerless over alcohol and could not manage our lives, and that there was a power that could relieve the alcoholism. And these 2 great facts are contained in these first 2 chapters. And knowing the mind of the alcoholic, I think that this chapter was placed there uniquely for this purpose, that the author paused long enough to give these guys 2 great ideas, 2 great facts. And I know how conniving they are. I'm going to use a whole chapter to try to destroy all the loopholes they're going to try to go through. So you notice uniquely that chapter 3 tells you about all the other things that other people tried to evade these 2 facts. So I think it is there that he pauses and takes a whole chapter to tell you all the different things that the guys tried, all the other cunning and ways that we tried to overlook these two facts and to try some other way out. And I think that this is the purpose of this beautiful chapter. It destroys, it tries to tell you some of the things we tried and other people have tried to keep from facing these great facts. And at the end it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times have no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a power, from a higher power. And then, after destroying us, getting us back on the two facts of the great ideas, then we come to another one of my favorites, we agnostics. We're laying groundwork in these earlier chapters, and we haven't gotten yet to putting the program together. We're still working on two great facts. And since we said that part of our recovery was something of a spiritual nature, a spiritual experience had to take place, then I think that we have to evaluate or prepare ourselves in our spiritual lives, or to evaluate what has been taking place in our spiritual lives. We have a great chapter that really promotes to me a spiritual kindergarten, a way, a how to bring this thing about. And it said, to one who feels he's an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And he comes back to the two facts again. To be doomed to an alcoholic death, which is the first fact, or to live on a spiritual basis, which is the second fact, are not easy, are the not easiest alternatives to face. Then it goes into lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power which could live and have, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But here and how and where we to find this power. And it says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves which will solve your problems. Which will solve your problems. As Charlie and I were studying earlier tonight, he said, which will not help you solve your problem, but which will solve your problems. Now, he goes into this agnostic, and I think that on page 47, it really begins to put together the spiritual kindergarten. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically show him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that this simple cornerstone is a wonderful, this simple cornerstone, a wonderful effective spiritual structure can be built. So we're going to have to build a spiritual structure to bring about a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And this spiritual structure is going to begin with a small cornerstone of believing. Believing. And I think that it's in these great small words that we know and use that that some of the ideas of the book are locked. And I hear people use, and I did, most of my life would use either one that comes to my mind, one or the other. They all sound the same. I would use the word believe. I would use the word trust, faith, either one, whichever you might choose. But in great study, we learned that the word believing is the beginning. I use the illustration about all the time about the man across the street. I like to use it around the place. I don't get changed. There's a guy across the place, a guy at a filling station, and Charlie goes over and has his car fixed, and he comes back to me telling how great this guy's work is. And there's two things I can do with Charlie's statement. My car needs some work on it. But there's two things that I can do with Charlie's statement. I don't have any faith in that man across the street, and I sure don't trust him. The only thing I can do with Charlie's statement, I can do one or two things. I can believe Charlie, or I can disbelieve him. And that's the beginning. Now, if I believe Charlie, the key thing is actions. I put some actions that to what I believed in, and I will carry my car across the street. And this man, and I carry my car over there. Now, after the man repairs my car, and I go over and pick it up, and I notice how well it runs, I no longer believe in him anymore. I got faith, some resemblance of faith. I know he's good. After I come back, but I begin with believing. Now, I might go back for quite a few years, and I might check him out when I carry over there and make sure he doesn't cheat me. And then one day I might go over there and I might say, hey, John, just go on and fix it and send me a bill. And little did I realize I got so much faith in the guy, I finally began to trust him. You know, trust comes later. And I think that this is where I have my trouble, you know, in my spiritual life. I had to evaluate my spiritual life in this great chapter. I always did believe in God, but I never acted as I believed. I acted as a disbeliever, which is no actions. So I never got results. I really never had faith in God. So these people told me, you didn't have faith in God. Say, you don't have to wait to have the faith of others. Said, all you got to do is believe. And I got a great guy, man, and I always bring this here our great plane, and he showed me many years ago. He said, you don't even have to believe in this thing. You can just be suspicious. That's about all belief is in it. You know, that's about all. It's kind of weak, you know. But this is where I begin, and it says, our belief, no matter how inadequate, is where we should begin. And I think that we so many times, if I just had his faith. And I think that this is our problem. Lack of action is our dilemma. And I never make this read this page until I think about the agnostic. And surely there was one sitting beside the pool. And he'd been sitting there for 38 years. He was a great believer. And Christ came by and asked him, said to do you believe? He said, yeah, you sure do. I've been here 38 years, you know. Said, when the water gets disturbed, you get in there, it'll make you well. And he asked him, he said, a very strange question. I guess the guy didn't want to use some foul language, but he didn't in this particular book with the stories. Christ asked him, said, do you want to be made whole? And now this is one hell of a question to ask the guy who's been sitting there for 38 years. I guess he'd say, what do you think I've been sitting here for? But it didn't really take a great philosopher like Christ to find out what was wrong with that man. He said, well, why don't you get in the water? Lack of actions. He believed. Been believing for 38 years. Agnostic. A believer with no actions. But he had never gotten in the water. And I realized that this was my problem. And like I always did believe in God. And I realized I used to ask him to take the taste out of my mouth for liquor on the way to the liquor store. Now, you know, that is not acting out in your beliefs. So believing is the beginning. And the great news of us, for us, that we have assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things of faith, which seem difficult to believe. There it is. And we're able in this chapter to evaluate just why. What is wrong with my spiritual life? I always have believed. Well, look, I haven't acted as I believe. We agnostics. Not atheists. Atheist is a disbeliever, which brings on no actions. Agnostic to me is a believer, but for some reason, no actions. No faith, no trust, no results. So it's in this chapter that we're able to evaluate what is wrong with our relationship with God. And this great chapter is a great study. He says, as soon as we can believe, we're on our way. And we know that our book says it's not as we pray, but as we believe, as we pray, that we're answered. And this is where that this thing begins to see. We can see why we haven't made this power work in our life. Lack of action, I think, is the greatest problem for most of us. And, of course, if we don't believe, then our problem is to come to believe. I think the chapter to the agnostic is probably the greatest thing that's ever been written for we alcoholics. Remember, in the book, Dr. Silkworth identifies the problem of alcoholism. He identifies the fact that I'm going to have a psychic change. He identifies the fact that when I'm sober, I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontented until I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes with taking a few drinks.
He identifies the fact that I'm going to have to find a way to live with peace of mind in order not to be restless and irritable and discontented whenever I'm sober. Identified with Bill and Bill's story. And then I read about the solution. And as I read about the solution, I read about things that I don't like. I read about spiritual terms and religious things and prayer and etc. And I don't like that solution. I read in the chapter more about alcoholism, the utter hopelessness of my situation if I don't find the spiritual life. Now again, these first 100 people were smart people. These people knew how I felt about God. These people knew I was born and raised in the Baptist church. And they knew that I heard nothing but hellfire and brimstone and damnation for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking whiskey and committing adultery. And they knew I'd been doing all them things all my life. And they knew that I was completely alienated from any God whatsoever. Surely in the Baptist church they talked about a kind and loving God. I don't know if they did. That message never did reach the pew I sat in. The only thing I heard about was hellfire and damnation. And I didn't want no part of God. And I didn't want any part of this spiritual thing. And I absolutely rebelled at the thought of having to pray. But through chapter 3 they convinced me that if I don't do this, I'm going to die from alcoholism. They tell me it's not an easy alternative to be faced with an alcoholic death or find a spiritual life. They knew exactly how I felt, and they wrote this chapter, chapter 4, and they called it We Agnostics. And through this chapter, I was allowed to learn of a different kind of God. I was allowed to learn that there is a kind and a loving God. I was allowed to learn that there is a God who stands ready to help any human being, and especially we alcoholics, the moment we honestly turn to Him and ask for help. And I didn't know where this God was. You know, as I grew up as a child, I thought God was up in the sky. I thought He wore long, flowing white robes. I thought He had long, blonde, shiny hair. And I thought He had a great big halo over His head. And I looked for God. And I couldn't find Him. I couldn't find Him when I was a kid. I couldn't find Him in the Baptist church. And on page 55 in the big book, in the chapter entitled We Agnostics, I found the most startling discovery that I've ever found in my life. The book says here we have been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world. People who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We have seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling that we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that He may be found. And it was so with us. And when I read this, it changed my entire, complete concept of God. When I found out that God dwells within me, and when I found out that He dwells within all human beings, and when I found out that the great reality is that it is only there that He can be found, then I felt I may have a God that I can get close to. I may have a God that I can talk to. I may have a God that can give me the help that I need, because no longer was God in the clouds. He was here, among us human beings. I think for me, as the practicing alcoholic, this is the only way that I could ever have made the breakthrough to really begin to want this spiritual experience. Now, at this point in the book, they have done some great things for me. They've identified my problem. They have given me a solution. They have convinced me of the utter hopelessness of trying to live without the solution. And now they have given me a solution that I can live with. And the next thing the book is going to do for me is tell me how to find that solution. And the next thing they wrote in the big book was chapter 5, and they entitled it, How It Works. And you remember we said it does three things. It identifies the problem, it gives the solution, and now it tells us how to find the solution. Chapter 5, How It Works.
I know that this is where everybody really starts off, as Charlie said earlier, in the fifth chapter, but I think we took quite a time tonight to try to get up to the fifth chapter. I think that this is the groundwork. I think the fifth chapter is the first progressive step, is the most, is where we begin to put something together, where we first are, where we are given the program of how to in chapter 5. And this is, cannot be sufficiently done until the groundwork is laid. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I won't go over this into great detail. Followed our path, but I think that I see this path, I see this thing as a great recipe of living. We know a recipe is like something that in which a person performs a task, and if they were designing a recipe of how they did it, then I'm sure if someone would pick up this recipe and follow it directly, it was laid out, they could not fail. A recipe does not fail. People fail. But recipes can never fail. And it says, follow our path. Now, I think so much as a path, and I see this little winding path as it goes down through the woods. And someone has preceded us, and as we go through this path, we can follow the path right where they went. You know, it even displays in a sense that there's not too much room. We can't see too far ahead or too far behind. And there is plenty of room on either side. But along the path, if we proceed, we will get to wherever the path is leading us. I think it goes into great detail, and here it mentions the first time, it mentions before we are given this recipe, which is over on page 59. It gives us great warnings, and three times it mentions honesty. And I think that these are great warnings, and I myself have trouble with the word honesty, because earlier it related, all honesty related to me in relationship with other people. And I really didn't think that this is the only sense of honesty that I knew. But I think that the word here is talking about self-honesty, and I think it's talking about truth, self-truth. And these words can bring out more things that I've heard before, that the truth will set you free. Freedom begins with truth. Truth will set you free from any situation, because truth will let you see it. And once you see any situation, this is when freedom begins. And it tells about this great, this evasive thing of truth that is necessary to, this is one thing that we must have. And it tells about some people who have grave emotional and mental disorders, but they can recover too if they have the capacity to be true to themselves. Then he gives us the great warnings of those who have walked before us. And he's talking about the first 100. These are they that speak. Our story discloses in a general way what we used to be like. Going back to the one fact. What happened and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, you are ready to take certain steps. And some of these we balked, the first 100. They are trying to tell us, you know, we balked.
But we could, we tried to find easier and softer ways. The first 100 tried this. They tried to save us some of the difficulties, the things that they had done. But we could not. And they beg us. They are begging us to be fearless and thorough from the very start, to keep from falling in the pitfalls that they had fallen into. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And it reminds us, even before giving us this recipe, that we are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. There one is God. May you find him now. And then in some of the greatest statements of the short statements, and this is one of my ideas of, this is about four words or five words. Half measures avail us nothing. And he goes on and he doesn't explode on these ideas. And I think, you know, a lot of times we wonder why some of the greatest ideas are about a half a page. And this is nothing like life. And most time in life I always was told, and I think that most of us have learned that you get out of life what you put into it. You know, you go to job today, and I went to school and I got put about half an effort and they gave me a half an education. I go to work some days and I would work hardly none, and that fool boss would pay me for a whole day. I got more than I put into it. And we usually say you get out of life what you put into it. But this statement says half measures in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't get out of this program what you put into it. Half measures avail you nothing. It's pretty low blow. You can put half a measures in this and you won't even get that back. Half measures avail us nothing. So it is different from most things in life. Then he says it gives us this great program, how this program works. It's finally going to give us these steps. Here are the steps which are suggested in the program recovery, and it lists the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in their order, which are part of, in the context of the book. Now we hear these things read, and I think that all of us have heard this, read many, many times at our group, at our meetings each week. And I think sometimes, as John and I said, it's the repetition that really loses the idea. Now, after giving this out, it says, many of you exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. And it says, do not be discouraged. No one among us have maintained anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. It says, we claim spiritual progress as a spiritual perfection. And then a structure is given us, and I think it is in great detail. He says, our description of the alcoholic. Charlie?
Doctor's opinion and Bill's story.
Yeah. The chapter to the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
Our adventures before and after.
Bill's story and the stories in the back of the book.
Now he's saying that the doctor's opinion would be discussed tonight, which is description of the alcoholic. The chapter to the agnostic, which is chapter 4. Our personal adventure, which is Bill's story and the story in the back of the book, bring out three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholics and could not manage our lives.
Step 1.
That probably no human being could relieve the alcoholism.
Part of step 2.
That God could and would if he was sought.
The rest of step 2.
So he's saying that he has taken the first four chapters in the doctor's opinion of the book to give you two great facts, to give you steps 1 and 2. And you notice, I don't care how in great study of this book, you will find no discussion in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, on steps 1 and 2. Because the author is saying here that I have used four chapters to discuss steps 1 and 2 and give you these two facts, which is steps 1 and 2. And then we don't read it in our meetings, but the very next line is very important. Being convinced we were at step 3. And we begin to put a program together in step 3. And the rest of this chapter will deal with 3 and 4. Steps 5 through 11 will be discussed in interaction. And he devoted a whole chapter to working with others on 7. So we see that the great book is wrote and designed over the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
The interesting thing that I find at this point of the book is you can read it from now on and try to find an explanation of steps 1 and 2. And they are never mentioned again in this book as far as any explanation of the steps at all. And the reason, when they handed me the book when I first came in and said, go to chapter 5 and do what it says, I looked at step 3 and it said, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it. It was an absolute impossibility for me to take step 3 without taking steps 1 and 2. And it was an absolute impossibility for me to take steps 1 and 2 without knowing why I needed to. And it was an absolute impossibility for me to know why I needed to until I had read the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters in the big book. And I found when I read them and understood them, I had already taken steps 1 and 2. And now I was ready to take step 3. And I want to do as Joe, I want to hit these warnings just a little bit more before we quit for the night. It says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. This book does not say if you need what we have. It says if you have decided you want what we have. This is a program for people who want it. It's not necessarily a program for people who need it. It said that some of these steps we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. What is nil for the alcoholic? To drink again. Let's tie these old ideas back with Dr. Jung's statement in chapter 2, when he talked about once in a while occurring as phenomena. He had seen people who had a sudden vital spiritual experience when old ideas and old concepts were suddenly cast aside and replaced with new ideas. And what they're telling me here is that look out, Charlie, you're going to try to hold on to them old ideas. And if you do, you're not going to have that spiritual experience. And if you don't have that spiritual experience, the results are going to be nil. You're going to go back to drinking. Now, to close it off tonight, I would like to read to you how it works from the original handwritten version of the big book. Because the original handwritten version ties some of these ideas together, and I think they lost some of the flow of the book when they run it around with all 100 people and they suggested changes and they changed some of the book before the original printing came out. And what I'm going to read to you now is how it works from the original handwritten version. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of life or a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly on our knees, ask him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. See that God can and will. If you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. I'm sorry they ever changed it. Joe, how do you want to close this meeting? Tomorrow morning now, we're going to start getting sober.
Thank you, Charlie and Joe. As the basket goes around, we normally say that we pass the basket to pay for a meeting place and refreshments. Tonight, we also want to pay for the gentleman's trip from Arkansas. Does anyone have any announcements? Okay, tomorrow morning, we've got coffee and donuts down here at 10 o'clock, and we'll run from 10 until 12, and then Charlie and Joe go back to Arkansas. Let's have a big hand for it, Charlie.